From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, the economic domino effect of COVID-19, from the stock market to oil prices. Then, a veteran who served 3 tours in Afghanistan talks about why he believes the U.S. military should withdraw troops.
Got friends with 10-plus deployments, and they don't have any rest. You know, we're exhausting this resource of our best people to protect us in a real emergency.
And 2 local dairy farmers talk about the crises facing their industry and their heritage here in Wisconsin.
When you're on this farm that was your parents' farm or your grandparents' farm or even further back than that, and you're the last one on the farm that all of a sudden can't afford to milk cows anymore or can't make it go, you kind of feel like you're leaving that heritage behind.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. While the COVID-19 outbreak has led to some heavy-handed approaches to public health, many of us may also feel the effects of the economy's invisible hand. The domino effect was seen yesterday when the stock market had its biggest single-day loss since 2008 due to concerns over the virus and an oil price war. Last week, the Federal Reserve did one of the few things it can do to bolster the economy. It lowered interest rates. Lake Effect's Julian Haida spoke with a local economist to learn about what might be next.
Stephen Cole, economist at Marquette University. Thank you for joining Lake Effect.
Very happy to be here. Thank you.
So first things first, I wanted to ask, before we get to some more of the recent news, about the Federal Reserve lowering interest rates last week, supposedly in response to the coronavirus outbreak. First, get us up to speed about what interest rates are and why the Federal Reserve sets them.
Mm-hmm. So usually when people see interest rates, you know, maybe front page of the newspaper, the interest rate that they usually talk about with the Federal Reserve is called the federal funds rate. And technically that thing is the rate that banks charge each other for overnight loans. Now, ultimately, this rate is set by market forces, but the Federal Reserve has a great deal of influence over this rate. And what's really interesting about this is that a lot of other costs of borrowing rates are tied to this. So this federal funds rate, these rates that you see tied to the Federal Reserve, this really serves as a benchmark for other costs of borrowing. So like your 30-year home fixed mortgage rates, the prime rate, other costs of borrowing are usually tied to this. So the Fed, when they usually want to try to maybe stimulate the economy, they usually try to lower this benchmark rate because all other costs of borrowing rates tend to go down with it. And then if they want to do the reverse, maybe slow down the economy, they tend to raise rates.
So for example, if I were to buy a car because I see that the interest rates are low, I'd be more likely to buy a new car, which comes right off the assembly line that creates jobs, right? Whereas if the interest rates were higher, it might cost me more to buy a new car, meaning that I might not be as prone to do so.
That's correct. That's correct. And usually, especially out of the most recent recession of 08 and 09, when you hear about 0% APR financing, those type of things, that's due to Fed lowering its benchmark rate really low. And then in tandem, like you said, your car loan, for instance, that rate will come down low. And that is to encourage, you know, consumers to take out a loan to maybe spread the economy or even businesses to take out loans to build new factories or buildings and those type of things.
And as such, then, more money is in circulation. So the inverse effect is when interest rates are low, more people borrow, meaning that there's a chance of higher inflation.
Perhaps, yeah. So that's really what you see in the textbooks and econ. You know, interest rates are low. If there's more money in the economy, usually in the long run, you tend to see more inflation. And recently, though, in the past 10 or so years, we have seen really low interest rates with the big money supply, but not as much inflation. So it's really interesting time now. We have low interest rates, somewhat low inflation with a big money supply as well.
Sure. So when the Fed decided to lower their interest rates by 0.5%, now it's around like 1-ish%. Mm-hmm. That's really low. After the financial recession of 2008, you mentioned, you know, the starting point there was around 5%. And, you know, there was a huge recession people hear about in the 70s where the interest rates before that were, you know, close to 30%. So, you know, when you hit that kind of 1% mark that we're at right now, we have more or less full employment in this country. Stock markets until a few weeks ago are doing pretty well. How much lower can you go if you're the Federal Reserve?
Exactly. And that's one of the big fears too. So historically, the Fed has the normal that maybe the average interest rate has been, you know, higher than what it is now. And, you know, usually during recessions, they lower this interest rate and that tends to boost the economy. But what was really, really interesting about the most recent recession is it was the most significant recession since the Great Depression. So the Fed, they dropped interest rates essentially to zero and can't go any lower than that. So essentially, when it drops to zeros, they lost a lot of their stimulative power from their conventional tool. And now with interest rates, and since the most recent recession, the interest rates have gradually gone up. But now, like you just alluded to last week, they dropped interest rates and the range is in between, the target range is between 1% and 1.25%. So one of the fears is, you know, if some big event happens, maybe adverse event happens that affects the economy, maybe the Fed might not have as much what we call conventional ammo to lower interest rates because they only can lower it by only so much.
So what are some of the alternatives? For example, I was reading that there's an internal memo at J.P. Morgan Chase just a couple of days ago. They're saying there's a 90% chance of a recession in our economy. Now, I don't know if you want to take that with a grain of salt, if, as, you know, as some have said, it's alarmism. But I'm curious, if there were a recession, as some people are saying, and we can't lower interest rates much lower than they are, what are some of the alternatives to, for example, stimulating the economy?
Mm-hmm. Well, first say that you know, we've been in a record-long expansion in the U.S. over 10 years, and all indicators before the kind of the coronavirus outbreak, a lot of indicators have said that you know we're still humming along, good GDP growth, relatively close inflation to our targets, but you know if another recession hits and like we lose the stimulated power from lowering interest rates if they hit the zero lower bound, a couple other alternatives that the Fed has used. One is large-scale asset purchases, or sometimes referred to as quantitative easing, where they purchase not just short-term government bonds, but more long-term government bonds to try to influence the longer-term interest rates. And then another one, too, is what we call forward guidance, where they give guidance on the future path of policy, maybe where interest rates are going to be in the future, for how long, or under what conditions will interest rates remain low. And that can have a lot of stimulated effects, because if businesses think that interest rates may be low, for instance, into the future, that can play into their decisions about what to do right now. So there's a couple other tools that they've experimented with. And right now, too, they've in the past year or so, they've been under this monetary policy review, say that, okay, we have this conventional tool, change the federal funds rate, but what other tools should we add to our package? So it's an ongoing process right now with some other tools they can use to fight off any recessions.
Sure. Now, I'm curious, you mentioned quantitative easing, issuing bonds as a way of kind of helping the economy, or kind of different ways of issuing bonds. You know, I'm pretty new to Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. I drive to work. I take I-43, and I see this massive billboard that I haven't seen in previous trips to Milwaukee. It was put up last fall, the national debt, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that debt, supposedly, or kind of traditionally is thought of as you know, coming from bonds and stuff like that. It's a little more complicated as far as I understand. But what do you see with regards to the state of our economy and this kind of really kind of scary looking billboard that without much context, it's at the side of the highway.
Yeah. So I think it's definitely important for people, for citizens to understand, you know, the number that the national debt is at right now. And I believe it end of 2019 fiscal year, I think it's about 79% of GDP. And that's for the largest since about World War II. And also too, end of, I think, fiscal year 2019, then annual budget deficit was about, I think, about 4.5% GDP, and historically it's been about 3%. And this is all, like you alluded to earlier, with essentially full employment. So that's kind of concerning for a couple reasons. Is you know, if we keep having to pay interest on all this debt that we have to service, that could potentially lead to maybe we have to allocate more funds to pay interest, whereas maybe those funds could be used for, you know, construction or education or defense or whatever. And then also, too, back to the recession, since we've already borrowed a lot, you know, if another recession hits, maybe there might not be as much political appetite to pass, you know, more stimulus plans. There's really no certain number this economy is going to be drastically affected. But it seems right now that, you know, people are willing to lend to us and we're not too much crowding out private investment. But it is definitely a big number, alarming number to be
sure
to notice.
Well, I mean, if in the case of a recession, if there isn't so much in a tax base, I mean, and this is, of course, the national debt. This is about government spending. This isn't necessarily about the state of our economy.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, but if there isn't as much of a tax base given a recession, then the government needs to think of other ways, whether that be issuing bonds to keep government services alive and mm-hmm. to keep a certain amount of people employed and money in the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, if a next recession happens, yeah, definitely they would have to. I mean, historically, what they usually do, you know, try to increase government spending or even decrease taxes. So like you said, you know, want to increase government spending, get more people jobs too. So that's like part of the fiscal side. And then also, you know, the monetary policy side.
It's also pretty different from 2008, which was, you know, people cite the bailout as being a pretty big driving factor. But that was the private sector that really kind of got the bailout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, since the most recent recession. A lot of it dealt with, you know, the financial markets. And, yeah, like you alluded to, like a lot of money directed towards the financial markets to kind of keep it on life support, at least save it so the economy doesn't, you know, teeter even further.
I do want to ask you the $10 million question.
Yes.
A lot of people tout the stock market. I mean, if you would have asked me a few months ago, I think if you have asked anybody a few months ago whether the stock market's doing well, the stock market was doing well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And yet people are talking about stagnant wage growth for years and years and years. I mean, slight wage growth with higher employment as of the last few years. But mm-hmm. what can we learn about the economy from looking at the stock market? Is the health of an economy dependent on the stock market? Every economist has been asked this question, but I want to ask you, Marquette University professor,
yes,
Stephen
yeah,
Cole.
Yeah, for sure. So definitely the stock market is one big indicator you should look at, you know, to determine the health of the economy. We have a lot of public companies on our stock market, as well as, you know, credit is really what we call like the lifeblood of our economy. And, you know, in the markets, that's where, you know, businesses get their loans and everything. So, you know, it's definitely part, one of the big key indicators you want to look at if you want to look at the health of the economy. But, you know, you should also look at it in tandem with, you know, how's GDP doing? How's inflation doing? And how's the labor markets doing? You alluded to slow wage growth. Yeah, definitely that was a concern about, okay, our economy's picking up out of the recent recession, unemployment's going down, but we haven't seen really wages rise. I'd say like very recently wages has started to pick up more, but overall in the past 10 years, somewhat slower. So definitely stock market is one key indicator, but it should be looked at in tandem with other big indicators, macro indicators.
Sure. Now changing gears a little bit mm-hmm. to the other big elephant in the room with regards to the economy, oil prices. So just yesterday we saw that Saudi Arabia was engaging with Russia on lowering oil prices. Russia is a major oil supplier, so is the United States. But Saudi Arabia is the kind of head of OPEC, the organization that leads a lot of other oil-producing countries, in driving the price of oil down. Now, they're saying this is related to keeping themselves afloat with regards to the coronavirus concerns. But at the same time, their cost of extracting oil and refining oil is much lower than for other countries. So what do you think this will have with regards to an effect on the economy here in the United States and more locally?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, with this kind of decrease in the oil prices, there could be, you know, a couple effects. You know, one, lower prices, you know, tend to help, you know, consumers when they purchase gas at the pump. So that could be a big driver too. Maybe more adverse effects would be, you know, since we're all in this kind of interconnected global economy, lower prices probably would hurt more countries that are more dependent on oil exports. So if those prices tend to fall, maybe that might hurt U.S. production who produce oil. So right now, yeah, they could have different effects. The question would be which one tends to outweigh the other. You know, would lower prices help consumers more, or would it help?
And might stimulate
hurt
the economy
exactly
where the interest rate can't.
Yeah, or, you know, lower prices hurt production in the U.S. or even abroad too, and that might come back to hurt us too. So
Sure. Now, I know scholars such as you don't always like to speculate, but just for sake of what people might be able to look out for, I'm wondering, you know, if, for example, this standoff between Russia and Saudi Arabia lasts a little bit longer, oil prices will remain relatively low. That would assume that other, for lack of a better word, more friendly oil producers to the U.S., so the U.S. oil industry, Canada, our neighbor, a huge oil exporter, they're operating at a loss. So after a few months or a few years of operating at a loss where they're selling oil at prices that are lower than it costs for them to produce that oil, because nobody can beat Saudi Arabia's overhead, low overhead. What would happen in that case? I mean, on the one hand, you could stimulate the economy because oil is cheap. But on the other hand, you have these huge oil companies that will be looking towards more shale extraction, which would presumably lower the price domestically as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you tend to see low oil prices and prices below, you know, firms' break-even points, then, you know, over the medium long term, you probably expect that maybe some companies might just cut back because they're obviously that wouldn't make sense to be in business. So it could further put pressure, upward pressure on prices too. But in terms of the U.S., you know, relative to maybe 20, 30 years ago, you know, since we have this big, you know, shale production, a lot of more supply of oil out there. So probably, you know, oil, the price of oil will remain probably relatively on the lower side, you know, compared to maybe historical norms. But yeah, it's just hard to see. And you never know, too, there's a geopolitical aspect to all this, too. So you never know if Russia and Saudi Arabia would, you know, come to an agreement or something like that, too, to maybe stabilize the price of oil. So it's, yeah.
Yeah, oil changes so quickly, unlike other kind of economic markers.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Now, I want to ask one more question. A lot of people were talking about in 2016 about how the election was really about the economy, about the forgotten man. So, you know, not to wade too much into the politics, but with regards to policy, how much do you think economics will play into this year's electoral cycle?
Yeah, even though we've been in a decades-long expansion, or over a decades-long expansion, excuse me, and low unemployment, you know, some of the benefits of this expansion have maybe not been as even as possible. So I think definitely voters look at, you know, how maybe a presidential candidate will affect jobs, will affect other needs, other services that they might need too. So I think that will definitely continue to play a big role in the upcoming election.
Sure, especially if the kind of volatility we've been seeing continues.
You see too that, you know, a lot of sometimes what drives the economy are, you know, people's perceptions about, you know, what's going to happen to the economy in the near future, consumer sentiment, for instance. You know, people think that economy is going to do well in the future. You know, that tends to keep the economy afloat. But if people are more pessimistic about things, then that can drive down the economy too. So that's another important indicator to keep track of when you look at, you know, people's perceptions about the economy.
Right. Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Stephen Cole is a professor of economics at Marquette University. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Stephen Cole, assistant professor of economics at Marquette University. He spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida. We'll take a short break, then we're joined by Sam Rogers, a veteran advocate who believes the U.S. should withdraw from Afghanistan. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. When the U.S. first invaded Afghanistan in 2001, no one imagined the conflict would last nearly two decades. But 19 years later, there are still U.S. troops on the ground. Although the U.S. government is currently withdrawing some troops from the war-torn country, the landmark peace agreement signed late last month by the U.S. and the Taliban is now in question. For Sam Rogers, this agreement is a step in the right direction, but the obstacles are all too familiar. Since doing three tours in Afghanistan, he's become a vocal opponent of what he considers an endless war. Rogers is now the Coalition's Director for Concerned Veterans for America in Wisconsin. He joins me in studio. Sam, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
So you did three tours in Afghanistan.
I did, with the United States Army.
First as an interrogator and then as an intelligence officer.
Yeah.
What were those experiences like?
Well, my first deployment was during the 2009 Afghanistan surge under President Obama. It was in the southern part of the country, you know, where there was serious fighting. It was certainly my most challenging deployment. Our unit, you know, suffered 40 soldiers killed, I think over 350 casualties, amputees. But at the same time, you know, there was – we were fighting, the enemy and protecting each other and retaking parts of Afghanistan that had been lost after 2003. And so it was also rewarding in that we could see the difference we were making and all that kind of stuff. And then my second deployment, 2012, 2013, Afghanistan was safer, but there was more – I was at a slightly higher level that – and I guess I saw more and more bureaucratic kind of infighting, you know, between government organizations internally in the military. It seemed like we were kind of spending more time fighting with each other, fighting over projects, stuff like that. And I left the Army after that, went to school here in Milwaukee at UW-Milwaukee. And eventually went back to the Army as a civil servant, as an intelligence officer, and I did a third tour in Afghanistan in 2015, 2016. That really solidified to me kind of this pressing problem that we're essentially making work for ourselves there, and I couldn't really be a part of it anymore. So I kind of, you know, talked to my wife and I said, yeah, I need a change of careers. But it was hard for me to walk away from you know, soldiers, sailors, Marines, Coasties, airmen who, you know, were in harm's way because I'm supposed to be that invisible line of defense, right? I'm supposed to be disrupting enemy networks and plans and thwarting attacks and ambushes and things before they happen. And so in 2018, after my one of my proteges, one of my former soldiers was killed in Somalia, I was taking some pre-law courses and really started doing some looking into the 2001 AUMF, which is the Afghanistan invasion document that was passed by Congress after 9/11. It's a very short document that describes why we're going into Afghanistan and what we're doing there. And that was the justification for having troops in Somalia in 2018. That really kind of shook me to my core and got me engaged in what is now this nationally coordinated campaign to end endless wars.
You know, you said something interesting about your third tour in Afghanistan that you found essentially, I believe the words you use are, the U.S. is making work for ourselves. What do you mean by that?
So, I mean, it goes by a lot of different terms. I guess mission creep is a good one. You know, the things that the American people sent the military to do in Afghanistan in 2001 were all accomplished very quickly, right? They destroyed the Taliban government, who, you know, were supporting al-Qaeda and refused to turn them over. They killed the vast majority of al-Qaeda fighters and commanders and stuff like that. And then we just stayed there. And the longer we stayed there, the more complicated those problems that existed well before we were there became. And so, and I think in that vacuum that's devoid of civilian leadership, right, civilian executive leadership, government organizations, government agencies, the military, they just find things to do. You know, the Congress never sent the military to Afghanistan to nation build, right? They didn't send us there to build shopping malls, but those are things we tried to do. And there's been lots of honorable attempts at good work there, but it's essentially make work, and it's things that the American people never really got a say in. And so these things have just been happening over and over and over again. I mean, it consumes a lot of resources, right? Spent over $1 trillion in Afghanistan alone. Consumes our most precious resource, which is people. 3,000 people have been killed there, in addition to, I think, over 1 million life-changing disabilities over the course of the Afghan war to service members. We've engaged essentially nonstop with our special operations forces and, you know, aggressively hunting the, you know, the worst bad guys there. But those guys and gals, part of that community, I mean, they do this stuff nonstop, back to back to back. I've got friends with 10 plus deployments and they don't have any rest. There's broken families. You know, we're exhausting this resource of our best people to protect us in a real emergency, right? In a real conflict that could arise. We're exhausting that resource. And we're at the point now where what should have been, what was designed to be, what was described as a punitive expedition, right, to go there and punish the Taliban and to take out Al-Qaeda, has turned into this thing where we're killing the grandkids of the people who started this. And it's unsustainable. But no one has stepped up in a meaningful way to end this. And so that's what we're trying to support. We're trying to bring people together, to stand together, to set aside hyperpartisanship for, if nothing else, just this issue, to engage the Congress to repeal that 2001 AUMF, which by both parties and both presidents has been reinterpreted over and over again to include invasions of like 40 different countries. And if we're going to send people into harm's way, there just needs to be a rigorous public debate in the Congress about it so that the American people can say, I don't think that's in our national interest. I don't want to see kids from my school, from my church, from my soccer team. I don't want to see them put at risk for this.
So the U.S. recently signed a landmark agreement with the Taliban. What did you think of that news?
It's a good step. It's great that the president, who ran on ending the Afghanistan war, is trying to take forward movement in this issue. But like I said, I have personally seen previous attempts, you know, under President Obama, whether it's reintegration into the government, whether it's ceasefires or peace deals, I've seen a lot of these things fall apart. And so it's not a replacement for withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. But it's a good signal, and I think it shows people that this is an area that they should be coming together on. I mean, this is probably the thing that the president and congressional Democrats agree on. We want congressional accountability. Less than 20% of the people in Congress who voted for the 2001 AUMF are still there, right? We want Congress to vote on these things so they can be held accountable to them. We want future AUMFs, authorizations for use of military force, to be extremely specific so that these things can't happen. I mean, the whole reason the War Powers Act was passed was to avoid this exact situation, and now we've been there twice as long as the Soviet Union was. And so we're not approaching this from an explicitly, you know, anti-war or anti-military or any of that perspective. We just want a future where the military, use of the military, is not the first step in engaging in other people's problem-solving process, right? It should be the last resort. And I think historically that has served our country extremely well, from World War I to World War II. You know, we didn't get engaged until it was absolutely the last possible choice. And because of that, we came out of those conflicts in a much better place than really the rest of the entire world. I think we need to recalibrate how we look at using our military to engage around the world.
Well, it feels like just from an outside perspective, there's been some level of degradation in that process since we entered the conflict in Korea. Since we went to Vietnam and then this kind of unfolding of the process as we've moved further into more recent decades.
Right. And we are the 800-pound trillion-dollar gorilla in the room. You know, people talk about like, well, how is Afghanistan going to adjust? Well, nobody knows what normalcy even looks like for them right now because everything that they do is built around us sitting there. And, you know, it's not the 1900s. We've got extremely high-quality telecommunication capabilities. We can engage diplomatically around the world without having to send the military first. We can share our vision for a better world through trade and educational exchange and diplomacy and all these other tools that are constructive and collaborative rather than deconstructive and destructive. And And I think that by focusing on using those using and exhausting those tools first, we'll be in a better place going forward in general.
So we're hearing now there's a persuasive evidence that the Taliban has no intention of abiding by the rules of this most recent agreement. Do you see a way of the U.S. exiting Afghanistan without working with the Taliban?
Well, I mean, absolutely. I think that this was an important attempt for this administration to seek, right, the most constructive diplomatic solution they could to support a withdrawal. But again, it doesn't change the fact that a withdrawal is what we need. Anecdotally, over three tours, I saw consistently the longer we spent there and the more work we did to try to pump up the Afghan government in our own image, regardless of if we ever considered that was even sustainable for them, the more the Taliban itself, right, became fractured, became tribalistic. You know, they have their own infighting, right, because it's constantly shifting from a political organization to a military organization to an insurgent organization, and there are various wings and factions. I mean, it's the definition of a quagmire, right? It's the longer we stand there in the middle of this, the more complicated it becomes and the deeper we get stuck. If we use a measure of, well, things are a mess here, and what if there's terrorism that comes out of here? Well, I mean, under that logic, I mean, the U.S. military should be sitting in, you know, 100 different developing nations who are unstable and could sustain, some terrorist organization might use them as a training camp. And that's just – it's just silly. I mean, I'm not surprised because, again, I've seen those previous attempts at peace cause fractures both in the government, cause fractures in these insurgent organizations, right? The Islamic State was imported, co-opted various factions of Taliban. Every country around Afghanistan has its own hooks into different insurgent groups, different Taliban leadership, which kind of speaks to the point of, like, these countries that are surrounding Afghanistan are investing time and energy into working with both the Afghan government and Taliban on their borders, right? Those are people who see Afghanistan's security is in their legitimate national interest. So why would we try to create something there that could only be sustained while we sit there and point a gun at it? When there are half a dozen countries there, you know, with substantial resources who actually will take benefit from Afghanistan becoming stabilized.
As you say, we have our hooks in – the U.S. government has – their hooks in so many different pockets now in Afghanistan. Is there an ideal scenario where they can get out?
Yeah, I mean, I think you put trucks on boats and you put people on planes. And, you know, obviously we make ourselves available for diplomacy, for, you know, mediation of future disputes. You know, we try to share our educational system to future leaders of that country because, you know, there's been inconsistent school, right, access since 2001. So you've got, you know, just generations of people who have lost that ability to grow outside of, you know, people who have taken advantage of the U.S. presence to enrich themselves, who have money to send their kids to international schools and things like that while other people just try to scrape by and feed themselves. And we need a reset. And then who knows, maybe we need engagement with Afghanistan in the future. But without this hard reset, without bringing folks back and saying, okay, if we want to do something with the military there, we need to talk about it publicly and rigorously, and we need a vote so that we can hold people accountable who make a bad decision.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think 60% of military veterans and families, right, all agree that we have to get out of there. The vast majority of the public is aligned on this issue, particularly in critical states like Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. I mean, that's where we've been focusing this campaign because the majority of people there, I mean, politically, you know, on across the spectrum from, you know, from Bernie to Ted Cruz folks can all come together and say, well, let's get our people out of there.
Well, Sam Rogers, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work with us.
Thank you.
Sam Rogers is a veteran who spent 3 tours in Afghanistan, and he's currently the Coalition's Director for Concerned Veterans for America in Wisconsin. The group will be having a symposium on endless war at the War Memorial Center here in Milwaukee on March 20th. Coming up, 2 local dairy farmers talk about the crises facing their industry and its future in the dairy state. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Just about every morning, Ryan Klusendorf wakes up at 5 o'clock to get his cows ready for the day. He milks them, he feeds them, and then it's time to start on paperwork before doing it all again in the afternoon. It's a job that Ryan and his wife Sherry have done for most of their lives. They're both third-generation farmers. It's a part of their heritage. But the last 5 years have put that heritage at risk. Like many dairy farmers in Wisconsin, the Klusendorfs have been faced with hard economic realities. Unlike others in their profession, they've been able to stay profitable, in part due to Sherry's job with Reister and Schnell, a John Deere dealership that works with a lot of farmers. It's a job that brings more than financial stability. It's also given Sherry a firsthand look at the challenges other farmers are facing. The Klusendorfs were featured in an article for this month's Milwaukee Magazine, and they joined me by phone from their farm in Medford. Sherry, Ryan, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Well, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
So I think sometimes people think of dairy farmers and they assume, you know, it's just you're out in the barn with the cows every day, but there's a lot of back-end work as well. It's running a small business.
Right, it is a business, and we look at our farm as a business. We got to be making sure we're being profitable. If we're not able to pay our bills or be profitable, it's probably something we shouldn't look at doing, where we, you know, get so far in debt we can never dig ourselves back out. But then on the other end, farming these days, you got to be more than just a farmer. There's a lot of regulations and legislation that goes into effect for agriculture, and you got to be willing to take time to speak up and be involved in that sector also.
Well, and that's something that you've been involved in, is that right?
That's correct.
What has your work been like there?
It's involved. You got to understand policy. You got to understand, you know, work with other people on issues and coming together to solve the problem or coming up with ideas together to move forward. I mean, there's a lot of time involved at off the farm too. So I got to have family and employees willing to step in times that I'm away from the farm to fill in my role and get the work done at home.
Yeah. Now, Sherry, in your job, you've had a chance to talk to a lot of farmers. So I know the last 5 years have been difficult for farmers all over the state, including you, but some have had it worse than others.
Yeah, I would say that it is a challenge. Farming is definitely a challenge. And depending on how you're structured with your debt, on how if you are able to continue to farm or not, there are quite a few dairy farms that have left milking cows and moved on to a job maybe in town or a job at an equipment dealer, and just dealing with the mental health of leaving those cows behind and selling them off to another farm is very tough for people to handle. And it's tough, too, in our business because we're there to help you at Research Now in the RIS department. We're there to help you with using technology to understand your finances a little bit better, understand the profitability of your acres that you have. And so it's a hard pill to swallow to also be part of a mental health counselor when they realize that they can no longer do it.
You know, you talked about something inside of there that the article in Milmag also gets to. There are people who say, well, you know, why not just sell your cows, do something else? What do those people fail to understand about your work?
I mean, it is a business, but these animals that you're taking care of every day, you're there every day. They're there every single day. And your job is to take care of them. And then one day you just, when you can't do it anymore, when you cannot physically take care of those animals anymore and you have to sell them off, it's like losing a part of your family.
When you sell off cows, where do they generally go?
I'm going to defer that one to Ryan.
Well, typically you can either sell them, you know, a private sale direct to a different farmer, or you can choose to go the auction route. At an auction, it's buyers come in, different farmers, or there's people there strictly just buying cows for other farms, and they'll go that way. Some aren't fit for sale to other farms, and they'll go direct to slaughter and get put into the food chain.
That has to be really tough after caring for an animal for so long.
It is, and we're finding that we need, as leaders in the egg community, we need to start looking at mental health training for ourselves so we can spot when people need to seek help, because suicide has been an issue lately in the agriculture world, and we want to make sure we're caring for our neighbors and friends that farm and make sure they're getting help that they need, because it is very emotional taxing when you can no longer continue a business that you've been doing for, you know, a majority of your life.
I was surprised to learn that the suicide rate among farmers is so high. It appears to be about triple that of the average population. Sherry and Ryan, when you're talking to other dairy farmers, is there this kind of overwhelming sense of sadness?
I mean, sometimes there is. You go into a farm and you ask them how they're doing that day, and it just depends on what happened that day on the farm to affect them. If it's been a good day and they've milked cows and they've had no issues, or they've, you know, gone out to the fields and they're able to plant, there's no issue. They seem to be a little bit more upbeat. And there's days where you have, you know, where you've lost a cow, or, you know, you've had a stillborn calf or something happens that just kind of turns you the other way. And then it's just a negative day that day. We try not to let that bring us down. We try very hard to stay positive thinking and that we're going to do and it's going to be okay. I think the biggest thing for a lot of these farms coming into this is, you know, it's a generational thing too. Ryan's farm family has farmed for years. And so when you're on this farm that was your parents' farm or your grandparents' farm or even further back than that, and you're the last one on the farm that all of a sudden can't afford to milk cows anymore or can't make it go, you kind of feel like you're leaving that heritage behind and you're letting down all those people that were in front of you before you. Milking cows. So I think that also is another stressor in the decision to sell out as well.
Yeah. You know, as we talked about a little bit before, the last 5 years have been rough for dairy farmers in general, farmers in general. What have the last 5 years looked like for you guys?
It's been tough. It's been very tough. But when we started out dairy farming, we set up our business that we were able to, you know, on a typical day, one operator could operate the farm themselves. And we set our farm up to have a low overhead. We weren't investing a lot of capital in equipment. We're investing in cattle, an asset that's reproducing. It's going to make us money. We utilized, in the summertime, rotational grazing, which gives us the opportunity to keep feed costs down. The cattle are out harvesting their own feed on a day-to-day basis, doing the work for us, spreading their nutrients out in the field where it needs to be, so when they're not up here in the barn, we're having to clean up after them, put it in the manure spreader, and drive it out to the field and spread it. The cows are doing it themselves. So we're finding that's been very beneficial for us in our business, but it's been a struggle, and we're able to continue on by the way we structure our business.
About how large is your farm?
We milk about 120 cows, and we farm about 400 acres. 200 of that is owned, and the other 200 is rented from neighboring farms that have decided to exit the industry.
Yeah.
Or landowners that aren't from a farming background that own the land that we rent from also. In the, I guess, the average size of the farm in Wisconsin, we're not a large farm. We're all the mid-sized farm, I'd say.
Okay. When you hear someone like Sonny Perdue, the current U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, say, you know, in America, the big get bigger, the small go out, how does that make you feel as a small business owner?
It's troubling, but it's the truth. I mean, that's the way it is, and until you can figure out a way to stop that, I mean, that's one thing we're working on, to figure out ways to help preserve small family farm that our rural communities thrive on and need in the community. That farm's generating income, and they're spending it in the community, and that dollar turns 7 times. It has the multiplier effect. The ways that we're looking at doing this, we're looking at some type of growth management system in the dairy industry to match to the supply of milk with the demand that's out there, so we're not overproducing a product. And by doing that, it should raise the price of milk to the farmer and not raise it much on the marketplace. And then farmers are not relying on government subsidies, which are taxpayer-funded. So it's a win-win for the farm and the taxpaying American.
Yeah, what do you think of the kind of bailout that has come from the Trump administration? Has it been helpful?
It has been helpful. It's helped us get through with the downturn. But I can tell you, the majority of the farmers, we don't want to be bailed out or subsidies. We want to be able to survive on the marketplace and not have to always turn to the government to get a bailout. But, I mean, that's another problem that's out there. We're relying heavily on export markets. And when you're relying on a foreign country to buy your product, it's very, I'd say, unstable. You know, you're not knowing what they're wanting and when they're going to want it and if they're going to continue to buy the agriculture products.
Yeah. So right now, the landscape of dairy farmers, we're losing a lot of them. And we're looking at, unfortunately, an immediate future where we may be losing more. What do you want to see happen to stem that loss?
Right. This past year in Wisconsin, we lost 818 dairy farmers, and I can see the number continue to rise. When these new trade agreements did get put in place, it has raised prices somewhat, but with the recent outbreak of the coronavirus, it has backed down. The markets have backed down due to that. So we're going to see more farms go out of business this year just because of increasing prices. They're able to get a better price when they sell their cattle, or if they decide to sell their land, there's going to be a better price paid to that. So it's going to be more incentive to those that are at the retirement age, or there's not a next generation to come in to play and take over that farm. Ways to, you know, help offset this, we need to look at ways, like I said, to match supply with demand. We need to show young individuals that farming is a viable occupation to take. So there are people to come in and take over these farms when people want to retire. But by doing that, we need to make sure that they're going to get a wage to live on to make it viable for them. Because every industry out there in America, you know, you buy your product to make your goods that you're going to sell. You know what your labor cost is in that. You know what it costs you to make it. And you're going to sell it for a profit. Where farming is, we can't pass those costs on like other businesses can. So our costs of business continue to rise, but the way the market structure is set up, we can't pass those costs on. So at times we're breaking even or doing it at a loss. Relooking at how our product is priced and how that price gets back to the farm as well.
Yeah. Well, Ryan, Sherry, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and talking about your work.
Yeah, thank you for having us. Hopefully we can reach that general public to understand a little better today.
Sherry and Ryan Klusendorf are the co-owners of their family farm in Medford, Wisconsin. Sherry also works at Reister & Schnell, a John Deere dealership. Ryan is on the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation's Board of Directors. The Klusendorfs were featured in an article in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. Daylight saving time means it stays darker longer in the early morning hours. But horse farmer Leah Sader finds that can lead to some beautiful sights for early risers. Here's her essay about an unusual encounter on her farm in Franksville, Wisconsin.
My mornings generally begin whenever I hear my small dog start to be restless. If she's up, it must be time to get up. This morning it was 5 a.m., which is fine. I do much of my best work quite early. I have always loved mornings and was an early riser, even as a child. After feeding the dogs and letting them out, I turn to feed my porch cats. On any given morning, there are between 4 and 8 of them. Barn cats, ferals, and recently a new intact male. I don't know if he is lost or was dumped. He waits as the other cats aren't keen to share with him. As I finish filling the dishes, I look up towards the barn, and that's when I saw it. The light that made me rush into the house and throw my coat on to get a better look. My good farm dog came with me, not the old one that woke me up, and I started towards the barn. I have always been outdoorsy. I camped frequently until I went into horses full time, which doesn't give one much opportunity for anything else. It took me a bit to get used to the farm cycles, so the first time I saw lights shining on the side of my barn, I was alarmed, to put it mildly. It was like someone was aiming a spotlight down the length of it. The barn is on an east-west axis, with the entry doors on the west end, with only our paddocks, pastures, and open fields to the west. That's where it appeared someone was shining a very bright light. So I went charging up there, wondering what or who I was going to find, and ready to give them a piece of my mind. As I rounded the corner of the old granary to where I could get a look at the perpetrator, I was stopped in my tracks. At the end of the farm path leading west into the open field, hanging low, but still a good way above the horizon, was the biggest full moon I had seen in a long time. I must have inhaled sharply at the beautiful sight, because I soon found myself short of breath. I have no idea how long I stood there just looking at it, marveling that such beauty exists in the night when most are fast asleep, unaware of it all. Eventually, I realized how lucky I was to have glanced up and thought I had a trespasser. We all know about the moon. I hope most people have stood and looked at it at some point in their lives. But on this cold morning, I thought about how fortunate I am to be an early riser, how fortunate that I keep my head up and pay attention to my surroundings, or I would have missed this glorious sight. The horses in the paddocks have stopped eating only to look at me, wondering what I'm doing just standing there. I know if I go in the barn to give hay to the stalled horses, that the moon will be gone when I am done. So I stand and take it in, thanking the universe for this lovely start to my day. Then I turn and go back to the reason I'm here, the horses in the cold, depending on me to throw them their breakfast.
Leah Sater is the founder of Stepping Stone Farms in Franksville, Wisconsin. It's a nonprofit horse rescue that offers therapy and programs for at-risk youth. You can find more information about Stepping Stone Farms at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.